You are Locked On Pirates, your daily podcast on the Pittsburgh Pirates, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Locked On Pirates, your Pittsburgh Pirates podcast of choice. My name is Jason Rolison, and you can find me primarily on the pages of BucksDugout.com and PiratesBreakdown.com. You can find my guest, Josh Taylor, on, well, everywhere. If you're not finding him, you're not really trying. You can find him on 93.7, specifically Buckle Talk every Saturday and the Sunday Morning Grind. And you can find him on KDKA hosting the Nightly Sports Call on the CW, as well as sports anchoring, anytime you might turn on your TV. So, Josh, welcome, and thanks for joining us again.
Good to be back. Always good to talk baseball with you, brother.
Absolutely. Josh Taylor, if you know him, you love him. And if you don't know him, get to know him because you'll love him. All right. That was my little intro I practiced. Not sure if it went over. We'll workshop it, but let's get right into it here, Josh, because, you know, my goodness, the Pirates are in a kind of a tailspin right now. We're not going to, you know, if you came to this podcast looking for answers, we may have some. We're not going to have everyone. We're going to try and help you understand what's going on. And to try and get my finger on the pulse of the fan base, what I've done on my Twitter account, and follow me at JRolisonPGH, is that and every day at noon, I'm putting up a poll. And this is just for me, just to get my pulse and see what you guys think about the storylines of the day or what have you. So, Josh, if you don't mind, I'm going to hit you with some of these polls and tell you the results, and we'll go from there and get your thoughts.
Let's do it.
All right. I'll start with the one today, which was, simply put, do you still have faith in Vasquez? And overwhelmingly, the answer was no from Pirates fans. So, Josh, what's your take on Vasquez and what's going on with him right now?
I think their lack of faith is very well placed and understood. I can't help but think that when people make jokes about, oh, what happened to Felipe Rivera, I like that guy better, I know they're saying it out of jest, but they're also not wrong. And that's what makes it, you know, it makes it a great joke, but it also makes it a very ironic truth.
Yeah.
If you really want to break down what's happening here. And now the one thing that we could see was promising from that last game in Arizona, at least we saw the velocity come back. We saw that. We saw the 98, 99, 100. We saw that, and we saw him throwing it for strikes, and that was the good thing. Did he use it probably a little bit too much with John Jay giving him six fastballs in a row? Probably. But at least the velocity was there, so you don't have to worry about that not being there anymore. So at least that's one thing that's promising. But at the same time, the walk numbers are back up again, and that's something that should concern anybody, myself included. The walk numbers being the issue. I want to say that going into this season, that was one of the things, that was my main concern with him, is can he keep his walk numbers down? I mean, it was to the point where, you know, in 2016, before he came to the Pirates, it wasn't as bad, but a 5.9 of walks in every nine innings, that was something that concerned you his first season here. But then he got it down. He cut it in half last year. It was almost 2.5. So you figure, okay, maybe it won't be as bad this time around, knowing that maybe cut in half that second season. And then, nope, all of a sudden it's back up to 5 for 9 innings. Mm. And that's becoming his biggest deal, because it's not even as much the strikeouts as it is a walk. He struck out 30 guys in 26.2. So he's around 10 per 9 innings. That's fine. But when you have half as many walks as you do strikeouts in the situations that you're supposed to pitch in, that's one thing that can't work for you. And I think that's been the biggest bugaboo for him. So at this point, I don't blame people for not having faith in him at all.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, going into the season, how great did we all feel about Vasquez at the back end of this bullpen? I mean, it was, you know, we work on this for Pirates Guide, and, you know, when we're going through this, you know, I happen to work on the pitching, on the prognostications for the pitchers, and I got to Vasquez and said, and 5 minutes later I was done. I was like, okay, you know, I have complete faith in him. And you mentioned velocity, so just to tidy that note up, from his outing yesterday against the Diamondbacks, through 36 pitches, 23 were four-seam fastballs, and that was sitting 96.7 average according to Statcast. Excuse me, 99 average, and maxed out at 101.4. Then he threw 10 changeups. So everything you said is absolutely valid, Josh. I think that, you know, he's not being as dominant as we all expected him to be in terms of the swing and miss stuff, or, you know, finding location or fooling batters. But the pitch mix is also really freaking weird. It seems like he's and, you know, it's not fair for a pitcher like Rivera to have a changeup, a 90 miles per hour changeup based off of his, you know, 99, 100 plus fastball. But I think he's relying on it a little too much. So it's something to watch going forward. But I don't know what else to say.
And that raised, Can I raise my hand for a second and remind myself that I was the guy that wrote the chapter of Rivero and Pirates Got 2018?
Oh, that's right. You wrote a full chapter.
So I looked at this, and I look at this and I go, wait a minute, how do we get here? And one of the things that intrigued me the most about Rivero was his pitch mix. That was the thing that made him so intriguing, was that he had that 100-mile-an-hour fastball, but he also had a changeup that was at least average, if not better, and a really good breaking ball to go with it. And I'm sitting there saying, okay, you have a fastball-slider combo. It's not a role as Chapman-like, but it's close. And you can offset it with a changeup or a curveball, very similar to a K-Rod. And that was the analogy that I used. And that fastball, he's not that tall of a guy. It's not like he's a big hulking guy like Chapman is. But then again, neither was Billy Wagner. So it really gave you all of those elements mixed into one and makes you think, this guy could really be something special. And then he comes into this season, and you say, wait a minute. What happened to everything that made him special? All those things are something that he's gotten away from. Each of them, you know, within themselves. Well, granted, the velocity he didn't want to get away from, but it did disappear for a while. But the pitch mix was something that he's gotten away from, and being able to mix up speeds and really deceive guys, he's gotten away from that. You wonder, you know, what's it going to take for him to get back to what he could have been, or at least he projects to be? And there's a lot of answers to that, and I don't think just one really encompasses it enough.
Yeah, it's just a combination of things, especially for someone to go from nearly lights out, rock solid, to being, you know, very shaky right now. And it's
right.
We're all searching for answers, and I think it's going to be – I happen to think it's going to get a little worse before it gets better, but that's just me. I'm doom and gloom today. I apologize. But if we move on, and this next couple polls are a good indication of gloom and doom. So for a couple days this week, I put out a poll saying – who's your quintessential Pirates all-star, and who's your non-star, the antithesis of an all-star? So
quintessential Pirates all-star.
Yep, and the antithesis of an all-star being a non-star. So readers voted for Cervelli for the all-star and Sean Rodriguez for the non-star, and I'm curious to see who your people would be, Josh.
My vote would be for Francisco Cervelli for the all-star, too. I think it's pretty much a no-brainer there. I think he's outperformed just about every catcher as far as offensive numbers are concerned. I don't think there's a question as far as Cervelli. My non-star, it will be easy to pick Sean Rodriguez, but he's also a guy who, in theory, is not a starter, at least not an everyday guy. I'm going with Gregory Polanco. I think he's probably the second most obvious guy as far as non-star, because he's technically a quote-unquote everyday player, even though Rodriguez has only played 10 fewer games than Polanco has. But on opening day, you would have slated Polanco being an everyday player, and he would actually be on an all-star ballot. I think that's really the thing that sets him apart. I would say Gregory Polanco as far as non-star. Up until maybe a week and a half ago, I would have made a case for Josh Bell, where at least he's starting to come around. He looks like he's seeing the ball a lot better, taking a bunch of walks, he's picking up good pitches to hit, and he's actually turning around and putting them in play. So my non-star is a pretty obvious pick for me. It's Gregory Polanco.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be either Polanco or Rodriguez for the non-star for me, simply because these guys are being relied upon. You know, Rodriguez had his fair share of starts. That's kind of what puts him right there with Polanco in my eyes. But I look at the overall commitment that the organization has made to Polanco, and that puts him a little ahead of Rodriguez for me. For my all-star, you know, my gut wants to say Cervelli, but I think he's been very surprisingly streaky after his first, you know, month and a week of the season. Right now, for June, for example, he entered June with a .282 batting average. He's posting an average right now, as we speak, of .263. So it's dropped some. He has exactly two extra base hits in the month of June, granted one of which is a home run. And he has
a pinch hit home run at that, off of Kenley Jansen, which is pretty amazing in and of itself.
Yeah, a pinch hit catcher home run. You don't hear that very often.
Not at all, especially not off Kenley Jansen.
And he struck out eight times in 28 trips to the plate in June. So he's a little too streaky for me to consider him an all-star. When I think of an all-star, I think of someone playing at a consistent level, not necessarily wire-to-wire, but large stretches of consistent play. And I also kind of want to put Corey Dickerson in that role for me as well. He was the second-place finisher in our poll, or my poll, and he's been as consistent as they come, even if the run production isn't always there at times. He's still getting on base. He's still dropping in hits and playing good defense in left field, so he would be my all-star. Neck and neck, though.
Hey, you know what? I wouldn't argue with you with Corey Dickerson at all, especially if you want to go with a guy who's actually played you know, the second most number of games on this team behind Josh Bell. He's even played more games than Jordy Mercer, who before he got sick, you know, a couple weeks back was playing a lot of time. So, you know, if you want to put Corey Dickerson as a guy who's in there day in and day out and been producing day in and day out, leading the team in hits, making second on the team in doubles, he's up there in home runs. I think he's still tied for third, and he's driving in the most runs on this team, or at least second or third most runs on the team. 119 OPS plus. His OPS is still over 800. Has the best batting average among the regular guys. You want to talk about guys doing it day in and day out, and his approach is consistent day in and day out. I think his attitude is pretty consistent day in, day out. I mean, every time, you know, we get the chance to talk to Corey in the clubhouse, it's pretty much a lot of the same thing. He's just like, hey, man, we're having fun. We want to go out and win games and giving his best effort and kind of just approaching it the same way. And you hear a lot of guys talk about, you know, approaching every day the same, not getting too high, not getting too low, just kind of riding it out, knowing that sometimes it's more about the process than it is the result. And I think Corey Dickerson's a perfect personification for that.
Perfect take. I have nothing to add. So let's move on to the next poll, which is the last one for the week. And, you know, when Nick Kingham got sent back down for Ivan Nova to come off the DL, you know, people were clamoring for Kingham to stay. So I asked you guys, which pitcher, starting pitcher, would you take out of the rotation to keep Kingham in? It was a very even poll. I put three options up there. Nova, just figure out another role for him, and Williams. And Williams won, but not by much. It was like 35% out of the three. So, and I think he reinforced that opinion with his start 2 days ago. So, Josh, your take there? Like, if Nick Kingham was to stay in, who would you get rid of in the rotation?
Going into this week, my answer would have been Ivan Nova. And then he comes off the DL. And I literally said this Sunday. My poll question of the day Sunday on my Sunday morning radio show was, who should stay in the rotation and who should go? My answer was Ivan Nova. And then he comes in off the DL and goes in and shuts down the Cubs. You're like, okay. But I just totally messed that theory up. And then you see Trevor Williams' last start, and it pretty much justifies a lot of people who are probably saying Nova or Williams. And I still see Trevor Williams as being that he's probably the typical five starter. He's never going to be great, but he's never going to be terrible. He'll have his ups and downs. But most games he pitches in, he might pitch just relatively well enough to keep you in it. But I think at this point, if you have five better options, then you don't feel bad about moving Trevor Williams. And that makes him my answer. And I'm a Trevor Williams guy. I've been a Trevor Williams guy since spring training last year. But I have to think, maybe it's his recency bias talking, but if you look at these guys in the last month and a half, Nova hasn't been great, but Williams has been significantly not greater in terms of, you know, describing how less effective he's been than Nova. So I think Trevor Williams right now is probably your odd man out. And that's tough to say because he was your best pitcher in April. But I'll also preface saying that with this. If Trevor Williams is your best pitcher in any calendar month, your pitching staff's probably not doing well, at least especially your starting rotation. So saying that probably is more of a reflection on the starting pitching, the rotation, then it probably is on Trevor Williams. But right now, my answer is definitely Trevor Williams.
Quick side note before I take a little bit of a deep dive on this. I guarantee you, when we look back at this 2018 Pirates season, I think pitch mix and how the Pirates starting pitchers approach hitters is going to be, we're going to look back and say, we talked about that a freaking lot, you know?
Yes, we do.
And here we go. And here we go with some more. So I looked at all of Williams' starts going into his last one. So these stats are through June 6th. So take out his last, you know, bomb of a start. Up until May, he never had an outing where he threw more than about 46.5% fast four-seam fastballs. And then suddenly May 3rd, it jumped up 51% in May 3rd, getting into the 65% on May 15th. And
wow.
Yeah, and what he was seeing was not using that sinker too much, but trying to build that slider up. Prior to May, Williams never threw the slider more than 13% in any start. Then all of a sudden, May 3rd, 23% sliders, 19% in an outing, 24.62%. The thing is, it's just not a very good pitch. And you can read the whole piece at Buck's Dugout. I wrote it up a couple days ago, but all this adds up to just some bad peripherals and something very peculiar. You hear a lot about the third time through the order and how it penalizes pitchers. Trevor Williams had a 5.03 WOBA against and a 16.5 ERA in the second time through the order in his four starts previous to his last one. And I looked even a little deeper, and it's seriously just all first time through, he threw about 56% fastballs. Second time through, about 52% fastballs. Fastball, 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 and then the occasional slider. It's just not going to work. And, you know, I'll end this rant by saying maybe he'll be the poster boy for change. You see Taillon incorporating a slider, Cool incorporating a slider. You know, maybe Williams will finally be the guy that the Pirates will perk up and say, look, this guy was so effective when he wasn't throwing it so much, that being a four-seam fastball. Maybe that'll be the catalyst. We can only hope. Anyway.
And you know what? It's funny when you point out that kind of pattern, because it makes me wonder if this is something that these guys are all just picking it up from each other, or if this is something that's coming from up top. But if the center's coming from up top, that's a little bit disturbing. I would be more inclined, if I'm Ray Sears, if I'm New Huntington, I'm telling these guys, look, do what you do well, figure out what you do well, and do that, and make that work. I can't see Trevor Williams being able to use his fastball and have his slider play off his fastball as effectively as a Jameson Taillon or Chad Kuhl, because Jameson Taillon and Chad Kuhl can hit mid to high 90s with their fastball in order to set up that slider. Trevor Williams, it's one of the things, I mean, probably six in the low 90s, but he's not going to top out where these other guys are, or it may not be as effective. Now, the one thing Trevor Williams does have going for him with his fastball, he's very, very good at locating it, at least for the most part. So maybe that's one thing that works for him. But I can't see him as a guy who's going to be as successful, maybe using his fastball to set up a slider. I don't see that as much, because I don't think either pitch is necessarily a plus pitch, if that makes sense. Okay. And when you look at that, you mentioned that string of games that he's had. I looked at his last eight starts, and this is something that I had to really go back and look, and this was something that pointed back to my discussion Sunday that I had about who should be the odd man out. Trevor Williams, in each of his last eight starts, has not given up less, is in three earned runs except for one. On May 15th, he went seven shutout against, of all teams, the White Sox. So it makes you wonder if it was just because of the fact that it was the White Sox. But in the other seven starts, he gave up at least three earned runs. Two of them, he didn't go past three innings. And a couple more, he didn't go past five innings. But when you look at all these, he only lost three decisions in that group, partially because one of them, the Pirates scored only one run, and in another one, they scored only one run. But then the last one he lost because he gave up eight runs, three of them were earned, even though the Pirates scored eight. So it's a really mixed bag for him, and it kind of goes back to that theory of sometimes he will pitch well enough to keep you in a game, and he may not lose as many, but he's also not going to blow teams away. But rounding it back around to my theory here on Williams is that I'm hoping that this doesn't become a thing where everybody just assumes, oh, well, this guy did it, maybe I can do it. I don't think that's the same, because each of these starting pitchers has different skill sets. So if you're really looking at what Jameson Taillon can do versus what Trevor Williams can do, you're going to run into a brick wall every time, because Trevor Williams is in no way Jameson Taillon, and vice versa. So by trying to get an understanding of what these guys are doing well and what they're not doing well, I think you've uncovered a lot as to why Trevor Williams may be struggling a lot, especially in these last eight starts.
Yeah, and just add more peculiarity, that May 15th start you mentioned, that's the one where he threw 65.96% four-seam fastballs. So, like I said at the top, we don't have all the answers. This is one of those
things. It is. I'm trying to figure out the word for it, but it's conundrum, maybe. Maybe that's a good word to describe just what we're seeing here. A lot of it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it's really just a Jenga block of mystery. So if you're familiar with Locked On Pirates, every off day, or usually every off day, we try to have a mailbag. Figures it's a good day to pass the time with no game. So we opened it up and took your questions from Twitter, from Facebook, from bucksdugout.com, and we're going to read through a couple of those now. So at P. David Glass on Twitter asks, well, and this is a very hot question, what will they do with a roster when Young Ho Gong is ready? Josh?
That is a great question. I would assume, just based on kind of the slowdown that he's had in Indianapolis, not some of that coming. It's one thing when a guy's had a couple of years of major league experience, when he goes into AAA and starts tearing it up. It's another thing when he starts out in high A, I think it was, and comes in immediately tearing it up.
Yeah.
Because he's already seen better competition. I always wonder what it would look like when he got to Indianapolis, right before he got on the doorstep, and I'm seeing that slowdown that I anticipated. If this keeps up the way it is, I would expect him probably to start coming around in late June, maybe early July to mid-July. If that's the case, you're near the midpoint of the season, you're near the trade deadline, and you're probably trying to make moves. of all the guys on this team, I don't expect to see long for the parish. I think David Freese is one of those guys. I think Tom Rodriguez is one of those guys, if for no other reason because there's better alternatives maybe coming behind them in AAA. Kevin Newman's an option. Kevin Kramer's an option. Max Moroff is an option. And then Jungle Gong's an option, too. If that is the case, I would imagine he would pick the place of Michelle Rodriguez or David Freese, probably more notably David Freese. If for no other reason, then it gives you a much better situation at third base as far as maybe a Gung and Moran type of situation, which honestly, given what we've seen from Moran so far this season and what Gung has done in the past, when he's at his best, it's not a terrible thing.
Yeah. And, you know, just a note on Kevin Newman. On his radio show for two consecutive weeks, Neil Huntington on 93.7 The Fan, where you can hear our guests, by the way, every Saturday for Bucko Talk and every Sunday for the Sunday Morning Grind. Neil Huntington has repeatedly mentioned that they consider Kevin Newman to be major league ready. And to quote Neil Huntington, it was, if there is a need, a shortstop, end quote. So you wonder, and Newman has played some second base, so you wonder if they have a really set plan with Newman. He's only going to play shortstop in the major leagues or primarily at the very least. But he's repeatedly said he's ready. And I think that, just to answer the question more directly, I think when they DFA'd Contos, that told me that they're okay with some sunken cost this year. The quandary they're in with Freese and Rodriguez is you want to play them enough to showcase them as a trade chip if you're going to go that route. But that's going to hurt your
club. Exactly.
Yeah, that's going to hurt your club. So what do you do? And I think you have to lean on, you know, past pedigree, past performance. So just from that note, and that fact alone, I think of the two, I think Freese would be the most likely to go because of his there's lesser unknowns there. Sean Rod is still coming off of the lost season last year, and thankfully he's healthy now, but there's the unknown there. And I think if you bring Gong in, all you have to really worry about is how you're going to cover Josh Bell backing up first base, and I think Sean Rodriguez might be that guy. So that's just my little take on it. I think Gong is definitely going to be here. I don't see why not. I think they're not going to put too much stock into his performance at AAA. I finally got a hit last night. He's 1-for-12 now, so we're still at least 2 weeks away from having to seriously think about this, but I think when he is ready to come up, I think Freese is the play to be packing his bags. Moving on to the next question.
I'd extend your theory about Rodriguez and Freese getting time to maybe showcase those guys. I'd extend that same theory to Gregory Polanco, too.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, let's take a little side detour here because I just want to see if you agree with me, Josh, because Polanco, everyone is a little bit down on for good reason at times. But I happen to think that his financial certainty with his contract kind of deflates some of the negatives about him in terms of trade value. How much do you think that actually helps his trade value, though, in your opinion?
I think right now it doesn't affect it, but when you look down the road and you see $8.6 million next year and $11.6 million the year after that, I think that's when people start to get a little shaky on him. But if you're, let's say you're an American League team that's hoping to turn a guy around, and I have this theory, never underestimate a team's ability to think that's a guy. So you got some American League team that says, you know what, he might not look great now. We can get him in the trade. We can tell him, hey, check that glove in. You're not going to need it anymore because you're going to be hitting. And just focus on being a designated hitter. Just go out every day and just hit. And he does that, and then in a year and a half, maybe 2020 comes around, and he's a 25-30 home run guy. And they're going, wait a minute, why'd they get rid of this guy? He's one of those prime candidates for the Pirates to sell off too early, and then he blossoms in the right situation, and then you wonder why they did it. Now, with that said, as far as the cost certainty goes, let's say that particular example happens. Let's say he does go to an American League team. Let's say he goes to a Kansas City or a Detroit or Chicago and becomes a really legit bat. Then that 6.1 next season, that $8.6 million in 2020, and that 11.5 in 2021 look like bargains compared to what the 4.1 he's getting paid might look like right now.
Yep.
So I think his cost certainty and his salary that he's doing the next few years plus, I mean, I think he's about to do a $3 million buyout in 2022 if you decide to let him not pick up the option. Although I can't remember if that's a mutual or if it's a team option. I think it's a team option going into 2022.
Team option.
Even if you want to pay a $3 million buyout, if you want to pay that buyout, even so, those next 3 years of salary, if he becomes even remotely productive, let's say he even matches what he was in his first full season, that really set the standard for what we expected for him, then those become pretty good valuable contract numbers for the next 3 years. I think a lot of it's really tied to what a team values as far as what he is and what they think they can turn him into. And if his production can even come close to his peak season or is better than that, then he does become a valuable chip in the steal in the trade situation. Now, I say all that based on what a team might think of him, because I talked about this previously. I talked about this on Bucko Talk and also on the Sunday Morning Grind. Gregory Polanco is one of those rare players where the scouting community tells you, big, strong body, can hit for power, can probably take some pitches, maybe a good OPS guy or a good run-producing guy, maybe can hit 20, 30 home runs and be a big part of the middle of your lineup. But then the stats community will say, the San Francisco community will say, okay, well, he can get on base to an average, to a above average clip. He's got some good power, hit you some home runs, hit you some doubles. He might be able to give you an OPS plus over 100. So both communities will tell you he's a good player, or at least he should be a good player. Then you go and see what you see, and you go, wait a minute, how did we get here? So he becomes more of a frustrating, confusing character in this whole drama. But, yes, I really do think that there's, for as much as people here are down on him, that there's someone in another market saying, keep an eye on that guy. He might be able to turn into a steal, because I'll remind people of this. About 16 or so years ago, there was a guy that Minnesota was down on. Boston snatched him up. He became a World Series champion a couple times, and he's probably going to be a Hall of Famer. That guy's name is David Ortiz. And the next day after they signed him, the papers accused the Red Sox of shopping at Walmart. So never, never underestimate what another team thinks that they can do with a guy who's struggling right now.
That is a good pull from you with that quote. That's excellent. I did not know that, and that's, you know, I have nothing to say. That was so excellent.
That's one of my favorite free agent stories ever. I read that in a book called Feeding the Monster, written by Seth Mnookin. He writes for Vanity Fair. That book is fantastic. If you want a really good baseball book to write with a lot of inside information, that is the one to read, because you get so much of a great story about a team that obviously did something that was pretty historic. But you get a lot more about what happened before, what happened during, and what happened after. And it's kind of a great tragedy in a way, too.
Yeah. Just I've heard about that book, and I think I'm going to have to get it after hearing that quote. But
I've broken the spine on mine. The cover's coming off. It's awful. I've read it like 12 times. It's terrible.
Well, you're probably going to buy it again. It's one of those CD. It's like a CD that you buy like 3 or 4 times, you know, back in the day when you bought CDs.
The next time I get it, it'll probably be on my Kindle, and I'll probably be well on the batter and reading that too. So there you go.
There you go. Just one last note on Polanco before we move on. What I think is the first team that talks to him, whether it's the Pirates or his next team, and says, look, just sell out for power, I think they'll get a lot out of him, because in his two great years, and pretty much for 3 out of the last 4 years, he's had very good hard hit rates, 30.3 in 2015, 35.7% in 2016, and still 34.9% this year. Soft contact, 17.3 in 15, 18.3 in 16. A little elevated this year, 21.8, but the point is he does not make soft contact often. I mean, how many times this year have we said to ourselves, damn, that was a loud out by Polanco, you know? So
The first he's team, also on pace for his 4th straight year with 20 doubles. So Don't discount that either. Some people don't really look at doubles, and I'll tell you, doubles are just as dangerous if in the right succession as home runs are. My high school coach used to always tell us, hit a double, start a rally, hit another, keep it going.
Yeah.
So if you got a guy who can hit doubles and he hit 30 in back-to-back years, and then 20 last season by being on the DL 4 different times, and he still hit 20.
Yep.
So if you can get a guy that can give you 20 or 30 doubles a season plus 20 home runs, he's going to be a really dangerous guy.
Already 17 this year as well. And
exactly.
He might end up being a poster boy for the three true outcomes theory. You know, he's striking out 23.6% of the time, walking 12%, highest for his career, and he's got the 8 home runs and 17 doubles. So, you know, three true outcomes being strikeout, walk, or home run, and we'll sneak in doubles there too, just to cheat a little bit. You know, he could be the poster.
That would be fair.
Yeah, he could be the poster boy for that kind of approach. But we have talked a lot of Polanco, so let's move on to the next one. it's kind of related, actually. At DSC TLC1, I hope I got that right, on Twitter, says, when will Hurdle grow a pair and field his best available players every day? And for Josh, that pretty much means, why does he stick with Polanco so much? Why does Sean Rod start so much? And I'll start this one off because I don't know why people are surprised about this. What in the Clint Hurdle era has led you to believe that he is not a player's manager, right?
Exactly. People always ask, like, oh, why is he always starting this guy? Why is he always playing that guy? Clint Hurdle, he really relates to his bench players a lot.
Yep.
Clint Hurdle was one of those guys very similar to Billy Bean, very similar to some of these other guys in baseball now. Clint Hurdle was a top prospect. Clint Hurdle was on the front of Sports Illustrated in the early 80s. He was, or I think it was the late 70s. But he was considered a top prospect. He was the next big thing. So if there's anybody that relates to what Gregory Polanco is going through, it's Clint Hurdle. He's the one that relates to a lot of what Polanco is going through right now. And then later in his career, he became a Sean Rodriguez. He became a guy that was the bench guy that was expected to come off the bench and hit cold and expect to do a lot of different things that he might not have been in the best position for. And now, granted, that's not absolving him in any way. Just trying to get to the psychology involved. But that's really the thing for him. He relates a lot to those guys at the end of the bench just as much as he relates to the hotshot guys that are coming up from AAA and expected to do big things. So he's going to relate to as much. He's going to relate as much to an Austin Meadows and a Gregory Polanco and a Josh Bell as he is to a Sean Rodriguez and a David Freese. That really is just that's just the history and the reality of it. Now, to answer the question, when's he actually going to put his best players on the field? Probably after he gets the worst ones off the roster. It might be after the trade deadline. It might be after they finally move those guys. But if he's able to move a Sean Rodriguez, if he's able to do something with a David Freese, if he's able to maybe, if not get a better production from Gregory Polanco, but maybe move that contract, then maybe you'll start seeing the best guys. Because after that, you'll have better options. But until that point happens, as long as those guys are on the roster, it's probably not going to happen anytime soon. And I hate to say that because you never want to see a team just go and fold and just put out what's less than their best roster. That's whether you're a fan or if you're in our position of a guy that's covering a team. I don't know why people think covering a bad team is fun. It's not. But for more or less for us, it's just the quality of watching and being able to observe and being able to follow as much as it is for what the outcome is. But as far as that's concerned, it's going to be when he has better options. And right now he doesn't have them.
Yep, that's a very good way to look at it. So a related question was from Ron J on Facebook, and he wonders why Hurdle's not on the hot seat. So this I'm not entirely sure about because, first of all, just on the field aside, everyone can pretty much agree, and I hope they agree, that Clint Hurdle was the right manager for this team at the right time in 2011. There's no question about that. What I'm curious about, you just kind of alluded to it a little bit, that he values veterans. But this is going to be a young team this year and an even younger team next year. You can start to ask, and I think it's fair to ask if he's the right manager for these young guys. Just to give you my answer, then I'll get your take, Josh. But I think Hurdle's not the problem. I really do think that might want to look at maybe some changes in the hitting coach staff and, heavens to Betsy, maybe moving Ray Searage out of an everyday role as a pitching coach and bringing that fresh voice and just a message more to the front. But like you said, once Hurdle gets rid of the bad players, give him a chance with only having the option to play good, young, talented players and see what happens. That's my take. How about you?
I would agree with that, and I'll say this much too. I will say that on the surface, the easy answer to this question as to why Clint Hurdle's not on the hot seat. Now, he might be on the hot seat from local fans. He might be on the hot seat with the local media because he's gotten a lot of criticism in the past month or so, and I've been on that train. I've criticized him too for other decisions that he's made. So he's not immune from any of that. For people that think he is, you're not paying enough attention, and you're just hearing what you want to hear. Clint Hurdle's catching it from all angles, but I don't think it's all his fault. I think a lot of what he has as far as decisions that he makes, I think a lot of it reflects on Neil Huntington, and that's not Clint Hurdle's fault. However, I will say this much. The main reason why Clint Hurdle's not on the hot seat as far as the organization is concerned is because he just got a new contract. Even after this season, he gets paid for three more, whether he manages his team or he doesn't. So if you want to look at the real reason why there's probably no urgency in doing anything with Clint Hurdle, it's because he's guaranteed to get paid for three more years. And I can see maybe this team taking some sunken costs with players' contract. I don't see them doing the same thing with the manager or with the GM for that matter. That's probably why neither guy is on the hot seat. That's probably my best explanation for that. That's the simple one. The more complicated one is that everybody knew going into this season that he was getting a hand dealt to him that didn't look like the rest of what everybody else was holding at the table. So there's going to be a little bit more leeway for him as there might be on another manager with another team with different talent and a different GM. But that's really what it comes down to.
So at this point, we've gone down some side roads, Josh and I, and came back with some stories to tell, and we've told them. So in interest of full transparency, we had some more questions, a lot of questions about the trade deadline. People are already starting to think about that. But with the detours we took today, I'm going to kind of take an executive decision and say we're going to hold off on those for maybe another week and maybe have Josh back next week sometime to do kind of an early, altogether too early look at the trade deadline just very briefly. So if you ask a question about that, don't fret. We will get to that probably next week sometime. So, Josh, I want to thank you for joining us. And can you remind people where they can find you on Twitter?
On Twitter, on Facebook, and also at Instagram, Josh Taylor HD. You can find me in all three places with the same name.
There you go. And you can find me at JRolsonPGH. So if you enjoy the podcast here on Locked On Pirates, I encourage you to subscribe if you're not already. Tell a friend. Leave a review. It all helps, and we hope to keep getting back on track with these as we go on with the season. So thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.